Time for Indie Week. John Feddersen with you again, reading the current issue, dated March 10th, 2021. It's from your North Carolina Reading Service and is intended for blind and print-impaired listeners. So, welcome. Before I start, as always, a brief thanks for our music today. We're indebted to the Battling Bisons, Bassoon Brigade. They're from the Baruch Bohannon Barbershop. And as they march out, let's open our Indie Week and get going. We'll get right to the hard news today. This one from Kathleen Hobson from Durham. School board member decries hate and threats from teachers. Mike Lee says he has voted with Durham's teachers consistently during his 7 years on the Durham Public School Board. But after he and other board members voted to reopen school classrooms that have been closed since March of 2020, he says he was barraged with vitriol, bullying, and personal threats from teachers. He said at a school board meeting Tuesday, after my vote to open up school on March 15, the hatred, the threats to myself, and the mention of my children in a few different comments showed me everything I needed to know, because it was all coming from staff. It was all coming from teachers. He said he weighed the health concerns of resuming in-person instruction and sought expert advice before casting his vote, but he was still met with accusations that, quote, he wants our teachers to die. He said, in almost every situation it has been with the proper protocols, schools can open, Lee said, but having that opinion apparently calls for hate and threats. That's where we are here in Durham. You disagree with us, you're dead to me. In a 4-3 vote Tuesday, the DPS board reaffirmed an earlier decision to begin bringing students and teachers back into their classrooms on March 15th, a year after the schools were closed because of the coronavirus pandemic. Some board members wanted to postpone until April 8th to allow more time for teachers to receive the COVID vaccinations. Teachers became eligible for the vaccine on February 24th, and the school district has been working with Durham County and Duke Health to vaccinate 1,000 school personnel per week. Board member Matt Sears said teachers had been blindsided by the decision to reopen, and he feared that it would undermine the trust the DPS board has established with Durham teachers. Delaying the reopening would help teachers, he said. And he said, for me, this is much about trust with our staff as it is about the safety factor. When I look at this district and this trust issue, I see a district that has worked for more than a decade to build something special with staff and teachers. We want it to be different from the top-down districts that we see around North Carolina. The back and forth over a start date for reopening has caused anguish among both parents and teachers. Many parents were frustrated because they had already canceled child care after the board originally decided to begin returning to in-person instruction on March the 15th. I'm very disappointed to hear that the board is considering changing the return to school yet again, said Katie Rudd of Carlton Crossing Drive in an email comment to the board. My family was so hopeful to return to school March 15th after nearly a year at home. This is not a game. Parents and children need follow-through on the existing plan, not a political stunt. Lee said he made his decision to reopen as both a board member and a parent. He has witnessed firsthand the toll that online learning can have on DPS students because he has a daughter in eighth grade who is only a frame of what she used to be. Lee said, do I vote against the interest of my child, who I know needs to be in school? I can't do that. As a board member, I look across the district and I see thousands of students and families who are in the same situation that I am. A lack of input around kids' welfare and mental health during conversations about reopening has left Lee concerned that teachers seem to only be prioritizing themselves. He said, when I met with the teachers before the emergency meeting, not one word was said about the health and wellness of our students. It was about what the teachers want. Michelle Burton, the president of the Durham Association of Educators, the DAE, and a librarian at Spring Valley Elementary, said teachers are not prioritizing their health only for their benefits. She said in an interview on Saturday, teacher working conditions are student learning conditions. So if teachers are not healthy, then they can't come to work, which means they're not educating kids. So that means you have to keep your workforce healthy in order to educate students in a consistent way. Lee said teachers have tried to shame parents away from returning their children to in-person instruction. He said, threatening families, threatening board members, attacking them for their opinion and beliefs, that's not organizing. Lee did not identify any specific teachers or provide details about threats. He did not respond to the Ninth Street Journal's request for comment. Burton said she was disheartened by Lee's remarks and did not know which teachers he was referring to. The DAE does not condone bullying of board members or any elected officials. But I don't know which educators he speaks of because he was speaking more in general, broad sense. I will say that educators have a right to advocate for their students and they have a right to advocate for their working conditions, but it should be done in a respectful manner. Sears, Natalie Bayer, and Alexandra Valladares voted to postpone reopening until April 8th, but the majority decided to continue with the original March 15th plan. Board Chair Bettina Umstead cast a deciding vote, and she said it was the most challenging decision she has made in her life. Elementary school students will return to class on March 15th. Middle and high students will begin returning April 8th. According to February 25 results of the parents' survey about choosing to return their child to in-person schooling or continue with online, 51% of parents said they would remain with virtual learning. 39% said they would return their children to in-person, and 10% didn't respond. DPS is providing cloth masks and face shields, disposable surgical and KN95 masks upon request, said spokesman Chip Sutterth. They are implementing physical distancing signage and other floor markings at six-foot intervals, providing frequent hand-washing breaks and hand sanitizer, collaborating with the health department on contact tracing and disinfecting high-touch areas throughout the day. School buses will be disinfected between routes. The staff is being trained on the proper use of personal protective equipment. All right, now from Durham, Tomasi MacDonald. 40 years after the Iranian Revolution, Durham has a small Baha'i community. 36 years ago, sisters Gila and Parvaneh Mostaghimi, adherents to the Baha'i faith, walked across the Lut Desert to escape imprisonment and possibly death at the hands of the Iranian government. Gila tells the Indy, during the day, our path through the desert was very hot. NASA identifies the Salt Desert, a World Heritage Site, as the hottest place on Earth. And at night it would be very cold. The only thing we were allowed to keep was our clothes that we wore in layers. We were thinking, how are we going to survive? The Mostaghimi sisters arrived in Durham in 1991. This year, they celebrate their 30th anniversary as intensive care unit nurses at Duke Hospital. Their parents, younger sister, and brothers all now live in the United States, but back home in Iran, Baha'i worshippers are still persecuted. Nearly 200 years before the Mostaghimis fled, the Baha'i faith, which teaches that humanity's great religions all come from one common source, was born in Iran. The faith traces its beginnings to 1844 when a merchant, Sayyid al-Muhammad Shirazi, who became known as the Bab, preached that he was the bearer of a new revelation from God and taught that God would send humanity a messenger known as Baha'u'llah. Among the chief tenets of the faith is the belief that a loving God has been called different names throughout the ages. The Baha'i celebrate equality between men and women, condemn racism, and champion the elimination of extreme wealth and poverty. Today there are 5 million followers from every racial, ethnic, and religious background. Parvaneh says that before the Iranian monarch Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was overthrown in 1979, that ultra-conservative country's 3 million Baha'i followers could gather for prayer and Sunday school. She says, it was freer. It was okay. It was not very liberal, but it was all right. But the new Islamic Republic and its authoritarian leader, the Grand Ayatollah, targeted Baha'i members with systematic persecution, accusing them of practicing a perverse sect of Islam. The Mostaghimis say that thousands of Baha'is were killed, their homes burned and looted, and the large Baha'i center in their hometown, Shiraz, was confiscated and turned into a government building. Gila says the persecution was a reaction to the Baha'i belief that God will send another messenger. In Islam, Muhammad is the final prophet. In January, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom issued a statement condemning, quote, the alarming escalation of government measures targeting Baha'is in Iran on the basis of their faith. These measures include a court ruling in December that it is illegal for Baha'i members to own property in the town of Ivel. Another court banned 8 Baha'is from participating in religious gatherings and forcing them to attend 5 sectarian counseling sessions at the Endiche Sajjadia Institute in Bandar Abbas. In December, the U.S. House of Representatives, for the 20th time since 1982, passed a bipartisan bill, House Resolution 823, condemning Iran's state-sponsored persecution of Baha'i citizens and the country's continued violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, as well as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Kathleen Heady is one of around 200 members of the Baha'i faith living in Durham. She says that the community is mindful of the persecution Baha'i members in Iran are again enduring. She says to the Indy, when you compare the Baha'i faith to the major religions, we're a small religion, so what happens to a few affects all of us. She says there's not much the local Baha'i community can do to alleviate the state-sanctioned repression of their fellow worshippers in Iran. She says anything we might do might put Baha'is there in more danger. But some Baha'i members living in the Bull City volunteer to teach college classes to Baha'i students through an online university staffed by instructors from all over the world. Gila and Parvaneh were college students when the government forbade Baha'i members to attend school. Gila recalls, they started coming to houses, knocking on doors and asking about identification. Baha'i soon realized the government used their identification to determine who was attending religious gatherings at their worship center. Once people were identified as participating in Baha'i services, the Revolutionary Security Forces arrived at their homes and detained them, Gila says. A pattern developed with the arrest and jailing of Baha'i worshippers. They would go to your house at night, she said. During the day, they would pretend everything was normal. The Mostaghimi family found a temporary solution to help Gila and Parvaneh avoid the authorities, sending them at night to the home of non-Baha'i relatives. Each night, guards would arrive at homes and read the names from a list of Baha'i members they had identified. They didn't know who you were, so they would read the list, Sheila says. At first, it was the youths they were going after. Sheila says several friends told her, hey, they called your name in my house, or they were calling your name. The sisters' parents were worried. Their sons were already in America, and their youngest daughter, Fariva, a middle schooler at the time, was too young for arrest. Sheila remembers when several Baha'i worshippers were arrested. They were in jail 1 year, she said. They executed them. The only reason is you are Baha'i. You don't have any rights. You're not allowed even to breathe in this country. The air you breathe is not for you. It's for the Muslims. Several months passed, and the two sisters continued staying in different relatives' homes at night. It wasn't easy for them to leave, as the government had confiscated Baha'i members' passports under the guise of renewing them. She says, they took our passports and never gave them back to us. For nearly 2 years, the sisters made monthly visits to the passport office, but were told their applications were not complete. A guard at the office told Gila she was wasting her time, she says, because they were not going to return her passport. He told her not to come back. The persecution continued. Baha'i students were barred from school. Baha'i teachers were fired. Businesses and professional licenses were confiscated. Government workers were dismissed. The sister's father lost his job as an accountant. Nurses were let go. Zila says they never stopped. When we left, there were 200 Baha'is in jail. They had hung 180. The government decided the only way you could get out of a jail was to put your house up as collateral. Anything you do, they come and get your house and you go back to jail. The government also started pressuring the sister's Islamic family members, warning them not to help their Baha'i relatives. Sheila says, they start distancing themselves from you. 7 years passed. Finally, the sister's father hired people to smuggle them out of Iran. Sheila says, you don't know who they are, but you have to somehow trust them. There were no guarantees of safe passage. Baha'i families were sending their children out of the country, but the Revolutionary Guard captured many. Others who left were never heard from again. Baha'i members' phones were tapped. Those who chose to flee couldn't tell anyone they were leaving. Sheila says, even my grandmother. The day that I was leaving, I went to her to say goodbye. I told her I was taking a trip to the capital city. In March of 1985, Zila and Parvaneh started their trek north on a flight to Tehran. They then caught another flight south to Zaidan, about 41 miles from the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. A truck driver met them at the airport and drove them to the hilly desert that they traversed on foot with hardly any food or water. They walked for almost 40 hours. Zila recalls, before, another truck driver picked them up and trailed two motorcyclists tasked with ensuring the route was clear. The sisters arrived at the Afghanistan-Pakistan border near the city of Quetta. Before crossing the border, the driver instructed the sisters to pretend they were a family arriving in the country for a wedding. The driver told us to pretend we were asleep and cover our faces with our chadors, Zila says. He told us if the guards see ladies, then they would not interfere with us. The sisters were uneasy. Parvaneh says, we didn't know what was in front of us. We didn't know it was going to be worse or better. The guard and driver exchanged words in Urdu. We got through. He let us pass, Sheila says. The sisters spent the night at a hotel. Once in the room, Sheila called her parents and spoke six words. Mom, I'm okay. Dad, I'm safe. Parvaneh said, I felt a sense of freedom, but we didn't know what to expect. It turns out they weren't completely safe. Sheila heard familiar voices in the hotel lobby, someone speaking Farsi, their native language. You'd better leave the city, a man who was Baha'i told them. You need to get out of the city as soon as you can. If they catch you, they will send you back. The man told them to go to the United Nations office. There they received identifications, and 2 days later, they flew to Islamabad. Their brothers, including one studying for a PhD at Virginia Tech University, agreed to sponsor them. Nearly two more years would pass before the sisters arrived in Blacksburg, Virginia. Zila says, including registering them for classes in English, math, and science, the Lutheran Church introduced us to the U.S. culture. They both earned nursing degrees. Parvaneh interned at Duke Hospital, where she appreciated the research opportunities and thought she could advance. She decided to stay in Durham and asked Zila, who was working at a community hospital in Virginia, to join her. They quickly found the local Baha'i community and attended worship services and activities at the Baha'i Center on Revere Road or at one another's homes. Over the years, the sisters have volunteered following high-profile disasters across the United States and abroad, including after the earthquake in Haiti in 2010 and with her team from Duke Hospital at Port-au-Prince, Hurricane Katrina in 2005, Hurricane Floyd in 1999, and its local homeless shelters once a month. The Mostaghimi sisters remain unmarried, but they say not unfulfilled, as they are surrounded by family while freely following Baha'i principles. Parvaneh says, we have dedicated our life to work and service. Service to the community is just another tenet of the Baha'i faith. Now, from Lee Taus in Raleigh, former head of Raleigh Montessori School pleads not guilty to aiding sex abuse at school. The former head of the Montessori School in Raleigh, Nancy Ericetti, will head to trial later this year for her role in a sex abuse scandal at the school after pleading not guilty and rejecting a plea deal from the state. The family of the victims and the state contend Ericetti knew a teacher at the school behaved sexually inappropriately toward a female student, but refused to act, resulting in the subsequent molestation of the girl's sister. The teacher, Nicholas Smith, was sentenced last summer to serve 17 years in prison for sexually abusing the sisters. As detailed in a lengthy indie investigation, Smith groomed the first victim, referred to in court as Jane Doe 1, beginning when she was a 12-year-old seventh grader at the school. Over time, this escalated to sending sexually explicit text messages and rape. A staff member at the school observed Smith entering the hotel rooms of teenage girls late at night on school trips and other inappropriate behavior, which she alerted Ericetti to via email. After Jane Doe 1 graduated, Smith began making sexual advances toward her younger sister, Jane Doe 2, who was also a student at the school, including grabbing her breasts and buttocks and attempting to kiss her. Jane Doe 1 said in court, "You destructured parts of me that will never be able to fully heal." The victims believe abuse against Jane Doe 2 would never have occurred if Ericetti hadn't turned a blind eye to Smith's behavior with Jane Doe 1. After learning Smith had behaved inappropriately with students at the school, Ericetti issued two behavioral plans in 2012 and 2016, respectively, to curtail his behavior, but he was never formally disciplined. The extent of her knowledge of Smith's behavior is unclear, and whether or not her failure to notify police of Smith's conduct rises to the level of abiding and abetting the molestation of the second victim will be the state's burden to prove at trial. The family of the victims gathered in court Monday to await news on Ericetti's case. In a statement from their lawyer, Robert Jessup, the family said they were disappointed, though not surprised, that Ms. Ericetti continues to refuse to accept any responsibility for her conduct that resulted in childhood sexual molestation and abuse. Continuing, although the process has been long and arduous, the victims could not be happier with the district attorney's office and court system, and they look forward to Ms. Ericetti's criminal trial this summer or fall. The victims remain optimistic about the next steps, and they are hopeful that by year's end, Ericetti would be convicted for her indicted crimes. Ericetti, a thin woman with a shock of blonde hair, declined to comment in court when approached by the Indy. A statement from her lawyers claimed she is 100% innocent and called the felony charges, quote, unprecedented. Nancy Ericetti did not know about nor would she ever aid in the abuse of a child, according to a written statement handed to the Indy by Ericetti's defense. There is no evidence that she knew or intended to aid in the abuse of a child. The statement goes on to call the charges, quote, a dangerous extension of the criminal law that should, quote, strike terror into the hearts and minds of North Carolinians. This case was a travesty of justice 3 years ago when she was charged, and it still is today. We are confident that when her case goes to trial, she will be thoroughly and completely exonerated. While it's unclear from the public record if Ericetti knew Smith raped Jane Doe 1, there is evidence that she was aware he had inappropriately touched her sister. According to a 2016 email from the victim's family, who threatened to withdraw her from the school if actions were not taken to protect their daughter. The email from the family states, quote, Mr. Smith has called her away from classwork to ask about how she feels about him and why she doesn't like him. She states she feels like his eyes undress me and is creeped out by him. Continuing, when she referred to being touched multiple times one day at school by him, she is referring to him repeatedly putting his hand on her shoulder, arm, and thigh while trying to have unwanted non-academic conversations with her, the email continued. The school defended Ericetti following a lawsuit from the victim's family and Smith's arrest in 2017. She continued to head the school at a $200,000 salary until her arrest in May of 2018, when she was charged with one count of aiding and abetting the taking of indecent liberties against a child under the age of 16 and one count of contributing to the delinquency and neglect of a minor. Following Ericetti's arrest, school leaders claimed Ericetti had no knowledge of the sister's abuse when she placed Smith on the two behavioral plans. Ericetti was later placed on paid leave. It's unclear if she was ever terminated or continues to remain on the payroll. Monica Rodriguez now serves as head of the school and could not be immediately reached for comment on Monday. Ericetti was offered a plea deal if she agreed to plead guilty to one count of contributing to delinquency of a child, but she rejected that offer. She rejected that offer in court Monday. After a full reading of the indictment against her, which stated the defendant as a headmaster was in a position to act and refused to do so, resulting in the abuse of Jane Doe 2. A soft-spoken Ericetti pleaded not guilty to both charges. Ericetti's trial will likely be scheduled for later this year and should take about 3 weeks, court officials noted. On to Sara Pequeño. In parts of rural Orange County, some residents still don't have good internet access. Earl McKee's grandfather and his neighbors chopped down cedar trees to create the first utility poles for Person County. Those poles eventually fed the electric wires that illuminated his dairy farm. McKee, an Orange County commissioner, is facing a different utility crisis almost a century later, getting internet access, good internet access, to rural parts of Orange County. It's something McKee struggles with. He says, "I've tried a few of the committee meetings at home, but I do almost all my virtual meetings in Hillsborough at the Whitted Center. Because if I'm trying to attend a virtual meeting at home, it's very problematic as to whether I'm actually going to be able to participate. I mean, I might be there, but you might not be able to hear me." He lives in a part of the county that isn't on broadband, a term used to describe internet service of a certain speed. Close to 5,000 county residences don't have broadband in 2018. Didn't have broadband, and its availability varies widely by census tract. FCC data show that 100% of Chapel Hill and Carborough residences are potentially able to meet the 25/3 threshold, meaning that users can download at a speed of 25 or more megabits per second or upload at 3 megabits per second. By comparison, more than 95% of the state's households have broadband access available. As you move north into the county, the number of residences that meet that threshold plummets as low as 41%, and the speed is slower. Jeff Sural, the director of the North Carolina Broadband Infrastructure Office, told Indy, "A family of four typically would need greater than the 25/3 to stream. If you have four users in the house and one is streaming a video, several are on emails, one may be gaming, you're going to need greater than the minimum threshold. Some may still consider high-speed internet a luxury, but the pandemic has proved that it's a necessity. Some students can't access classes or their homework. Adults could find it nearly impossible to work. Telehealth isn't always an option, prompting many patients to brave doctor's offices. Libraries are normally a solution to poor internet access in the home, but many have closed. Local school systems created their own remedies." Orange County Schools Superintendent Monique Felder says the school system had to provide around 1,400 students and 200 teachers and staff with hotspots to keep up with their school days. The numbers are similar at Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools, according to a representative. Hotspots are expensive solutions, and many work only in the short term. Alamance County families told Elon News Network that their hotspots still didn't provide enough bandwidth for the whole household. McKee petitioned the Board of Commissioners in November to create the Orange County Broadband Task Force to tackle the issue. That group includes McKee, Sorrell, Commissioner Sally Green, representatives from the two school system, and Durham Tech, and others in the community. At the first meeting, March 4, they asked the question, how does broadband expand to the rural parts of Orange County? This isn't the county's first time tackling broadband access. Green became aware of the issue while serving on the Chapel Hill Town Council in 2011. She says, Chapel Hill on its own was hoping to be able to provide broadband service under the law as it had been before it was changed. That same year, the General Assembly and its brand new Republican majority passed Session Law 2011/84, or Level Playing Field Bill. The bill prohibits municipalities from creating internet cooperatives, like the ones that exist for electricity or water. Time Warner Cable, now Spectrum, CenturyLink, and other communications companies backed that bill. Legislators sold it as a means to preserve competition. Bill Faison, a former Orange County representative, told WRAL at the time, let's be clear about whose bill this is. This is Time Warner's bill. You need to know who you're doing this for. That 2011 bill is reminiscent of private efforts in the 20th century to dissuade the legislature from creating public electric cooperatives. As with electric companies, the state tried to incentivize communications companies to create rural broadband service. These incentives rarely apply to counties like Orange, with a mix of rural and urban areas. The state's growing rural economies with access to technology, acronym GREAT, grant program, applies only to counties with the most pressing needs. Orange County has one of the highest median household incomes and lowest unemployment rates statewide, despite its varying census tract data. The Level Playing Field Bill has forced Orange County officials to look for their own incentives over the last decade, including partnerships with private companies. In September 2018, Orange County government began a three-year partnership with the Waxhaw Internet Company, Open Broadband, with the hope of taking 2,700 residences online. Though the contract still has a few months, it's clear the goal was never realized. Jim Northrup, the county's chief information officer, told the Broadband Task Force that 10% of those residences, fewer than 300 homes, would have wireless internet by the contract's expiration in October. The company was not prepared for the county's lack of vertical assets, or tall things to put equipment on. Without towers, skyscrapers, or billboards, there's no way to make fixed wireless work. Other solutions, like fiber, can be expensive to build. Internet service providers don't fall under the North Carolina Utilities Commission, which regulates the quality of a service and determines local need for it. Without that regulation, the wealth in Chapel Hill and Carrboro can't make the rural parts of the county more attractive to private companies. If companies can't turn a big enough profit, then they won't improve service. Even if municipalities could form cooperatives, they may run into their own issues. Searle says a municipal co-op model has worked well for some counties, but not others. A lot of municipalities do not have the resources to build a network. A lot of them don't have the know-how, Searle says. He says Wilson, the poster child for municipal broadband in the state, had an electric cooperative in place. City officials already knew how to run a public utility. City employees knew how to hang the wires, and the city already owned the poles. In 1933, the state began laying the groundwork to electrify its farms with a government program. In April 1935, North Carolina rural electrification officially began. The federal program was created under the New Deal in May. President Roosevelt was communicating with the state during the program's inception. Governor Roy Cooper calls rural broadband access a priority. So do House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Leader Phil Berger. Nationally, the first two stimulus packages had money that could be used for broadband, and more could be included in the third package currently moving through Congress. There's a possibility this momentum could all change as COVID-19 fades away and we slowly return to our normal, distracted lives. None of the people to whom the Indy spoke for this story think that's likely. Even after the pandemic, people will want to work or shop from home. Students will still need the internet for homework. McKee says, I've heard the tax issue and the cost issue. Can we afford to do this? My response is, can we afford not to do it? Chapel Hill is voting to rezone the 1200 block of MLK Boulevard this week. Residents are asking the town council to say yes. The Tar Heel Mobile Home Park is easy to miss, whether you're driving down Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard for the first time or the thousandth. 73 homes are tucked behind the now-defunct Marathon gas station, obscured by dense foliage. In 2018, the mobile home park and gas station were sold to Stackhouse Properties. The original owners supposedly sold it under the condition that the 73 residences would keep their spaces. To do this and make money, the group submitted rezoning requests to include a self-storage facility on the property and open a new gas station in the old Marathon space. On Wednesday, the Chapel Hill Town Council will vote on the rezoning process for the second time. The council first voted on the proposal February 24. The request passed 5-3, but since it did not receive a two-thirds majority upon first reading, the rezoning is heading to council again. The residents of the mobile home community, mostly Latino families, are largely at the mercy of the council. Through connections with the Chapel Hill Carlborough NAACP, El Centro Hispano, and Empowerment Incorporated there are asking the council to uphold its yes vote, despite concerns over precedent. Councilmember Tai Huyn wrote in an email to Indy, residents say they don't like the storage building and the project in principle, but as one resident put it, principle isn't my roof. My family needs a roof. Every resident I've heard from has stated that housing stability and remaining in this community for their children's future are their biggest priorities. A yes vote potentially gives the residents 15 more years in their homes, according to a proposed covenant between developer and town. A no vote could mean eviction papers and 180 days to move. Supporters say that while they dislike both options, they are prioritizing the option that is most likely to keep the mobile homes on the property. Donna Jones, the NAACP chapter president, told Indy, the way we think is best to support these families right now is to make sure they have somewhere to live until the town comes up with a better solution, and that means voting yes. While the families have not spoken on the record for fear of retaliation, El Centro Hispano did a canvass of Tar Heels residents. They presented these findings at the NAACP's chapter meeting on Saturday. Dolores Bailey, executive director of Empowerment and a member of the Chapel Hill Carlborough NAACP, says one woman said the town didn't care about her family. Bailey told Indy, that woman and everybody else in that park has as much right as anybody who lives over in the Oaks has. They work. They pay taxes. They live here. Their children go to school here, and yet she can say, and I absolutely feel for her, that the town doesn't care about them, and that's why they can play yo-yo with them. It's not right. The children in these families mostly attend Chapel Hill Carlborough City Schools, a highly ranked public school system. If they're forced to move their homes to a different mobile home park, they'd likely have to move out of the district. Tenants currently pay $400 to $500 a month for the land their homes sit on, about a third of the average cost of an apartment in town, according to Rent Cafe. Aside from the cost, renting mobile homes is one of the only options for undocumented migrants in need of housing. The proposed agreement between town and property owner would also move residents to annual leases instead of their current monthly lease situations. The covenant would also require Stackhouse to keep rent prices lower than 115% of the market rates in Raleigh or Charlotte. Opponents worry that this would be illegal under current North Carolina law, which prohibits rent control, except for within public or subsidized housing. Similar issues arose in 2018 when Lakeview Mobile Home Park was almost sold to make room for luxury apartment complexes. The NAACP and Empowerment were also involved with those discussions. Ultimately, the developer withdrew their plans. Since the initial vote, and after the public hearing process closed, some town residents began Save 1200 MLK in an attempt to bolster a no vote. The group claims the council could zone the neighborhood differently to keep the families safe, a decision that couldn't be made on Wednesday. The NAACP presentation reminds readers that development can only be approved or rejected. No one can force a developer to keep a business open. Jones says we have to be urging the yes, because that right now is the only proposal where the developer agrees to keeping these families in their home. Okay, let's get to a couple of food-related articles. Community gardens in Raleigh may now sell produce on-site. If you've ever ordered the locavore salad from the Fiction Kitchen, then you probably nibbled on microgreens grown in Tommy Perdue's shipping container. The Raleigh urban agriculturalist can grow up to 3 tons of microgreens a year out of the 325-square-foot container, and at one point she sold produce to about 160 local restaurants. In November 2019, her company, Sweet Pea Urban Gardens, joined forces with the Well-Fed Community Gardens. That's a 1.5-acre operation on Athens Drive in southwest Raleigh, owned by Irregardless Cafe founders Arthur and Anya Gordon. Having just sold the beloved cafe they founded in 1975, the Gordons hoped to spend their retirement ramping up production at the farm with Purdue's assistance. The plan was to sell mostly to local businesses. Then came COVID, and overnight their customer base disappeared as restaurants shuttered their doors and laid off staff. With nowhere to share their harvest, Purdue and the Gordons conceived a workaround. Why not sell directly to customers from a farm stand? So Purdue applied for a permit from the city that spring and filled out the necessary paperwork. But city staff told her no. City code, it turned out, prohibited community gardens from selling their bounty in residential neighborhoods. You'd have to take it elsewhere, to a booth at the farmer's market or a welcoming shop, they said. Purdue said it was very clear the city wasn't prepared for farming inside of the city. Dissatisfied with that answer, Purdue took matters into her own hands with the help of urban agricultural advocate Jen Peeler Truman. Purdue crafted a citizen petition requesting a text change that would alter the definition of a community garden to allow farm stands in residential zones, and brought her request before the council last August. It was the council's first virtual meeting following a summer of unrest due to COVID-19 and ongoing protests downtown. Most of the speakers were signed up to talk about the city and police department's mishandling of the protest, but Purdue was there to talk about a farm. She matter-of-factly told the council, "The sales of our organic produce to neighbors will support the health of the community and earn income for us to train new urban farmers." Currently, the Raleigh Unified Development Ordinance does not support the needs of our community garden or any community garden to open a produce stand. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin, who was wearing a bright blue Carolina Panthers jersey, nodded her head. She recalled working on the matter of farm stands years ago during her decade-long stint on the council. She asked then-city manager Ruffin Hall to prepare a staff report and draft a plan on how the council could update the city code. Last week, in record time for municipal government, the Raleigh City Council unanimously approved the change, which permits urban gardens throughout the city to sell on-site what they grow. The text change to the UDO removes the requirement for a special use permit in order to set up a farm stand at a community garden. Depending on the size of the garden, the stand can be up to 1,200 square feet and cannot operate past 8 p.m. Restrictions that seem reasonable in residential neighborhoods. Purdue says, being able to grow right here and having folks come up and buy right here is like a dream. Can you imagine a better life? The change won't just help Sweet Pea and the well-fed, but it will also allow dozens of community gardens throughout the city to make their products available in neighborhoods that currently lack walkable access to fresh food. Have a backyard? You too could build a farm stand. City Council member Jonathan Melton says, anything we can do to put goods and services closer to people where they are, that's important. I want to build a city where we can promote small-scale neighborhood retail, so this is a step in that direction. And it helps address food deserts. It makes sure there's healthy food in more neighborhoods. For Truman, who has long advocated for the expansion of urban agriculture throughout the city, the change is just the beginning. She plans to bring more requests to the council in the coming weeks. She says that we really see this produce stand effort in the UDO as a first step. There's a list of other things Raleigh could be doing to be more friendly toward urban agriculture we'd like to see. This isn't the only thing that needs fixing, but it's an exciting first step to be fixed. Next from Sarah Edwards, work up an appetite. This is about a second Cheney location, expands Preeti Wass's mission of serving Indian American snacks that educate and inspire. On a Thursday afternoon at Cheney, in downtown Raleigh, Preeti Wass answers her phone, pausing briefly to greet a customer who has just walked in with a question. I am so glad you stopped by, she can be heard saying cheerfully in the background. We have a good menu. Wass has only had her spot on the ground floor of the Poynard YMCA open for a little over a year. It opened in November 2019, just 4 months before COVID-19 brought the restaurant industry to a halt. Still, the little Indian-inspired tea shop persevered, and when opportunity came knocking recently to open a second location at the Alexander Family YMCA off Hillsborough Street, Wass took it. This second Cheney location opened on March 1 with an expanded kitchen that allows for a larger menu, which will include naan zas, buttered brioche rolls, bun maska, and a full menu of coffee beverages alongside chai. A touch of both serendipity and tenacity define Wass's journey in the Raleigh food scene. A former adjunct culinary professor at Wake Tech, Wass's two small-batch food companies, Sugar and Spice Kitchen and Jolly Good Jams, became gateways to Cheney when the Poynard YMCA reached out to her a couple years ago to see if she wanted to take over a vacant cafe space. The location was a perfect match for her passions for nutrition and education. 3 weeks after that first phone call, Cheney was open for business. My approach is to food. Yes, you're coming to work out, play basketball, whatever, but of course, nutrition is a huge part of that. People tend to associate a healthy lifestyle with taking things away. You deprive yourself of such and such, or you don't eat carbs. In India, it's actually the opposite. Indian food is, by and large, very, very healthy. It's meant to fit what your body needs during that particular season several times a day. It's a very comprehensive approach. Over the past year, Wass says she has tried to stay relevant and resilient with a healthy, comforting menu of fresh-made masala chai, savory Indian-American snacks, smoothies, and baked goods packed with a wide range of grains, including buckwheat, einkorn, sorghum, and millet. Wass's gluten-free Indian millet cookies with lemon curd, for instance, are particularly eye-popping. The opportunity to open a second location, she says, was also unexpected, but proves especially exciting because it gives her the chance to hire during a time when people so badly need employment. It will also allow her to expand her mission to educate, not just through eating food, but through teaching kids how to prepare and serve food. Says Wasa, who's been cooking since the age of 9, as we get more settled, I'll be teaching workforce development classes. Because the Y naturally has a big population of youth that are underserved and kids who are coming in for after-school activities and play basketball and things like that, I'm going to be able to give them barista training and teach them serve safe classes and customer service. That piece of it excites me so much. And has been the case at her current Cheney location, Wash says she expects the menu at the Alexander Family Y to keep promoting conversations. She says, at first glance, it seems like a regular menu. There's coffee and sandwiches, you know, the regular menu. Then you see chili cheese toast, or you see the heading for tiffin and are like, what the heck is a tiffin? It prompts those questions. We really get to have a lot of conversations, and I could talk about food all day long, even in my sleep. Now, just a couple of days ago, on March the 5th, a documentary opened for theaters and on-demand streaming called Stray. And here's a review of Stray, which was given a 4-star review by Glenn McDonald. Dogs are the best. Everyone knows this, from their natural playfulness to ferocious loyalty to their advanced napping skills, dogs are a model of how to live life properly. The Greek philosopher Diogenes of Sinope thought so too. Human beings live artificially and hypocritically and would do well to study the dog. So reads one of the introductory title cards to director Elizabeth Lowe's masterful new documentary Stray, which tracks a trio of wild street dogs through the streets of Istanbul over the course of several months. Istanbul is unique among major world cities in that dogs are allowed to run wild throughout the metropolis. In fact, it's illegal to euthanize or confine strays anywhere in Turkey. Using a low-to-the-ground dog's eye-view camera, Lowe follows these dogs as they go about their day, scavenging food from street vendors, dodging traffic, and stoically accepting the occasional ear scritch from passers-by. Lowe's style is strictly old-school and observational. Nothing is framed for drama or cutesiness. Instead, we're invited to marvel at the calm self-reliance and amazing resourcefulness of the pups. The star of this remarkable film is Zeytin, a tawny colored mutt with dark and expressive eyes. The camera often lingers in extreme close-ups on Zeytin as she surveys her surroundings, and the effect is startling. You can see thoughts and feelings moving across her face and body as the city bustles all around. Packs of dogs form and disband throughout the day, and the cameras occasionally split off to track Zeytin's supporting cast, the affectionate doggo Nazar and the shy puppy Kartal. The dogs seem to have been named by their regular neighbors, the vendors and workers, who treat the roaming packs as just another fact of urban life. Quite deliberately, the film regularly cuts into another trio, three teenage Syrian refugees who are also living on the streets of Istanbul. The boys and the dogs team up some nights, sharing makeshift beds in abandoned construction sites. By paralleling these two groups of survivors, the film offers a kind of oblique commentary on Turkish society at street level. Mirrored sequences show how the city dwellers treat the dogs and how they treat the refugees. The film passes no judgment on what it observes, and there are no cheap tableaus of manufactured outrage. This is just how it is. Actually, both the boys and the dogs are often treated with similar kindness, which is a complicated moral observation in itself. One powerful scene shows the boys racing off to queue up for free food handed out by a social service provider. The kids take the plates back to their sidewalk campsite and immediately scrape off half for the dogs. Animal lovers may be scared off by the premise of this documentary or worry that it's some grim portrait of suffering. There's nothing to fear, though. No animals are hurt or even particularly distressed over the course of the film. Well, a couple dogs get into a half-hearted fight over food at one point, and a cat gets chased up a tree. But the filmmakers are chasing a different kind of vibe, one in which we're invited to admire the ragged nobility of these beautiful city animals. Stray is a positively uplifting film in the end, a celebration of the canine spirit, you might say. And at only 72 minutes, it's oddly short for a feature documentary. Be sure to stay for the end credits. The filmmakers saved their best shot for last. Again, the title is Stray, and it's available on demand. And I just have time. I'll have to skip a few articles, as I often do. It's 15 Minutes with Daniel Tobin, age 32. And this is a feature called 15 Minutes. Environmental advocate, founder of the Earth Steward, and Triangle Trash Guy. And it's a question and answer. On any given day, Chapel Hills, Daniel Tobin can be seen collecting trash along the highways, parks, or waist deep in a stream. In 2020, he collected 2,300 bags of trash and has already collected 343 bags this year. And I'll skip to the important part. Why does cleaning up litter mean so much to you? And he answers, I think that for us to be successful as possible, it requires us to try to strive for a standard of excellence. Now, I'm afraid I will have to bring this little interview to a premature close with his last little paragraph. Plastic takes over 500 years to decompose because it's very inert, and we've created half of all the plastic ever produced in the last 15 years. Dealing with trash and plastic is an inevitable part of our future because we're only producing more of it every year. I think of it as people can either be apathetic and choose to join that club, or they can choose to join the club of people who care and who are motivated to make the planet a better place. And that's people like me for the North Carolina NCReadingService.org, John Fetterson, who's choosing to make this a better place by getting off the air. And hopefully you'll be along for next week's reading of Indie Week. So long.